Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I'm Alex Newman, Associate Editor of the magazine, and I'm filling in this week for Dan Jones. Today I'm joined down the line by Companies Editor Mark Robinson, back from a knee checkup, I think. Mark, how was it?
No real improvement, unfortunately, but that's just a function of age, I'm afraid.
Okay, well, a downbeat note to begin on. I'm very pleased to say I'm joined in person by our economics writer, Hermione Taylor, as well. Hello, Hermione.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And Christopher Akers, who in a big week for Scotland and Scottish politics has come all the way down from Edinburgh to talk the Edinburgh reforms and Iron Brew. So a warm welcome to you as well, Chris.
It's great to be here, Alex. Yeah. Thank you.
So as well as Chris's cover feature, which is on the so-called Big Bang 2.0 and what this small galaxy of proposed reforms might mean for the UK's investment landscape, we're going to be talking about the US debt ceiling and talk of a challenge to the hegemony of the US dollar. But we're going to kick off with our result of the week, which is the FTSE 100 engineering group, Smiths. If you look closer, you will see us, says Smiths in its marketing literature. I suppose the implication of this is that it's the sort of business that flies under the radar a little bit, Mark. You covered the results. Can you just sort of sketch out briefly before we talk about the results for those who might not know the business, what it does?
Oh, well, it's probably one of the oldest listed companies in London, or at least it started in about the mid 19th century, I believe, and then it was a sort of precision watchmaker or timepiece maker. It had a long-standing relationship with the Royal Navy over here as well. And then in the post-war period, it was one of the more, it was a dominant supplier of instruments like odometers and measurement instruments like that to the British automotive industry. It increased its footprint in the aerospace market in this company, both civilian and military. And since the turn of the millennium, that's remained a sort of an important part of the business. But it's now been broken up into four distinct division. I think the largest might be Smiths Detection, and you've been subject to their products, whether you like it or not, because if you go in and out of most airports through the world, the security scanners, a lot of these are made by the detection unit. And then we've got to John Crane as well, which produces systems process technology for things like the oil and gas, chemical and pharma industries. Smiths Interconnect, that's a producer of electronic components and subsystems. A lot of work there through OEMs as well. And the other smaller part of the business is the Flex-Tek's engineering components. And that's to do with heat and fluid transference and gas as well. So it's a broad-based engineering firm. I used to get in a bit of strife when I first covered them, and going back a few years as well, because I used to refer to it as a conglomerate. And it isn't in the strictest sense of the word now. And it's a more focused business now, because for about, I think for the longest period, 2 or 3 years, it was trying to hive off its medical division, which didn't sort of quite fit in with those businesses I've just outlined there. That was a process which put a major strain on management as well. It was an underperforming part of the business. You know, the margins were fairly slack by comparison. That's gone now. I think that went at the beginning of 2022, and a lot of those funds generated by that are being returned via share buybacks too.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've got lots of disparate businesses here, even though there's, you know, as you alluded to, there's a bit more of a joined up thinking to the business than there has been in the past. I mean, the first half numbers were out last Friday, showed record growth, it looked like across all the divisions. So so you know, whatever these different plates are, they're all spinning at the same time. What's kind of driving earnings, or been the biggest source of of upside for the business of late?
Well, I think the detection business performed very well, as did John Crane. With detection, obviously, that's a bit of a recovery story too, because a lot of the volumes linked to that technology dissipated almost overnight with the lockdowns. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a major correlation there to the civil aviation industry, and of course, when that ground to a halt. As did a lot of orders, even though these tend to be on sort of long-term contractual arrangements. But that was a major problem for the business. So we've seen a bounce back there. A good year for John Crane as well. The impression that I got just looking at industry analysis as well, and after having spoken to the company, it's the rate of organic growth which was the most pleasing element. The company beat consensus forecasts, and management was able to increase guidance for the full year. But the main part is that I think they were looking at a 25% increase in the value of sales, but this was broken up between, there was obviously inflation played a part in that, but a high proportion was linked to volume growth as well. And it's that organic growth that really pleased the market itself, because I mean, that's where the business has struggled in years past.
So, I mean, in more generally though, would you expect a business like this to kind of revert to, you know, GDP level, you know, trend growth, or are there elements of the markets they're in which you know suggest they could be above trend, you know, in real growth markets, or what's your thoughts?
Well,
there,
obviously, when you look at their supplies to original equipment manufacturers, there's definitely a correlation there, or a wider correlation to aggregate demand in the economy, and that held up reasonably well during lockdowns. I guess if you're looking at anything that would be above the average rate would be Smith's Detection, because of the growth in the anticipated growth in civil aviation volumes across the globe. You know, we've seen that, but it's been in recovery mode for two and a half years. Yeah, I think that's the part of the business that you're likely to see the more outstanding growth rates. But part of the reason why the results were so well received as well, apart from that organic growth, is because since they've hived off the medical unit as well, there's been changes at board level, and in the article I think I alluded to some comments from analysts at Goldman Sachs, which to the effect that, I'll quote here actually, according to the analysts, they're saying the company's entering a new growth phase following fundamental changes in the group's leadership strategy and portfolio. So it's more joined up thinking, I guess, a more focused management team, because it's a more streamlined group now, and more focused. So it was a pretty good set of figures, and there's nothing to suggest that won't keep on improving through the remainder of this year. And it's not overly encumbered with debt as well, which is only about 17% of net assets. So the forward rating as well, it doesn't sort of scream value, and I think it's about mid range in terms of market peers, but it's the forward yield's about 2.5%, the forward dividend yield's about 2.5%, so we think it's not a bad sort of buy and forget option for your portfolio as well, and there we have it.
Yeah. And so sort of very confident noises from management as well, on the rising order book, and lots of talk about organic growth continuing. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, I didn't mention that, but yeah, the orders are heading in the right direction. I guess I guess one point to look at in the full year results as well is because they're getting a high proportion of orders in now from original equipment manufacturers, and that tends to or can have the effect of depressing margins. But we'll have to analyse that at the end of the year.
Okay, so before we wrap up the company section of the podcast this week, I wanted to briefly touch on full year numbers for AG Barr, which were also out this week. Chris, as previously mentioned, you covered the figures this week. What were the big headlines for the full year to January?
Well, firstly, AG Barr posted some pretty impressive revenue growth. Sales were up 18% in the year, helped by higher prices, some volume growth, and the strong brand equity AG Barr has with its products. Profits were up 5% as a result of that, but the company also warned about short-term impact on operating margins in the new financial year, and that hit the share price on results day. Margins also struggled in the latest year due to cost pressures. The gross margin and the cash profit margin both fell.
Yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned there in terms of the brands, I mean, you know, as ever with beverage companies, but, you know, it's all about the brands, isn't it? And what's, you know, what's trending well, you know, at any given time, you know, at a brand or product level, where's the growth at the moment for AG Barr?
So at a high level, both of the company's main divisions, which are soft drinks and cocktail solutions, posted some pretty strong sales growth of 16%. At a brand level, Rubicon, which sells energy, sparkling and still drinks, was a standout performer. Its revenues were up by more than 20% and volumes were up by 8%. On the cocktail side of things, AG Barr is taking advantage of growth in the market. On-trade sales at its Funkin brand, the cocktail brand, were up by 23%. Sales at the famous Iron Brew, on the other hand, were up by a less impressive 6%.
So another point you mentioned is the deposit return scheme in Scotland was cited as having, you know, this potential impact on consumer purchasing behaviour. Did the company sort of give much more detail on this? And you know, given there's sort of similar schemes in place around the world, has there been much sort of analyst chat about the experience elsewhere?
Yeah, so for background, the scheme is set to go live in August in Scotland, and it will add a 20 pence deposit to alcohol and soft drinks in single-use containers. And the idea is to boost recycling rates, so people will get the deposit back when they return the empty container. As you say, many other countries around the world have some form of deposit return scheme. I think the German system seems to be particularly successful. But there has been a lot of pushback on the scheme from industry. I spoke to a Scottish whisky consultant and broker called Blair Bowman earlier this year about the scheme, and he called it the most onerous, most complex deposit return scheme in the world, which isn't good. AG Barr have said they were well advanced in preparing for the scheme, but as you say, they also mentioned it could impact consumer purchasing behaviour. Previously, Investec analysts have also mentioned it could add up to £3 million to AG Barr's annual costs. And I think it's worth mentioning as well, there is a lot of stuff on this going on at the moment in the Scottish Parliament with the new First Minister. So there could be movement on this, either watering it down or even scrapping it, depending what happens.
Yeah, and I suppose customer, you know, behaviour adapts in the long run, doesn't it? You know, there's this initial change, or, you know, we saw it with the sugar tax as well. And then I suppose behaviours adapt and, you know, brand equity doesn't get diminished just because, you know, there are. I suppose, externalities to consider that we didn't before. Just to sort of round out, I mean, AG Barr, you know, the balance sheet looks in a pretty good position as well. They've got, you know, they're in net cash at the moment. Just get a sense from the results what they're planning to do with the money. Is it about boosting production or adding new brands or upping distributions to shareholders?
Yeah, so the company has about £8 million of net cash on the balance sheet now. I spoke to Chief Executive Roger White for the article, and he said, while the focus is still on organic growth, the board is open to looking at more acquisition opportunities given the cash position. Just for background, it made two acquisitions in the latest year of a Bis Drinks and an oat milk company, so getting involved in different areas.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, I definitely see lots of school kids near where I live drinking the Boost drink. I mean, that's not necessarily an endorsement of the product or a good thing, but yeah, they love it. Okay, well, from Cumbernauld to Washington and to our economics writer, Hermione Taylor, who's been following two stories that have been rumbling on in the background while everyone's been fretting about the US banking system. Both very large and complex topics, somewhat connected, but let's break them down in turn. Hermione, let's start with the dollar or the dollar's place in the world as the reserve currency. Before we sort of jump into geopolitics and the thornier questions about currency flows and everything, why is the dollar so important to investors?
I mean, I think we've had a really good example recently. Following the banking sector turmoil that we've seen, the Bank of England and five other central banks actually announced a coordinated effort to try and keep credit flowing. And they did this by boosting the flow of US dollars through the financial system using liquidity swaps, which means that they can exchange US dollars daily instead of weekly until the end of April. And I think this really shows that the dollar is at the heart of the financial system. Aside from that, we've got some pretty striking facts as well. So the US dollar is involved in 90% of all foreign exchange transactions and almost half of world trade. And dollar assets make up 60% of the world's currency reserves.
Mm. So, I mean, it backstops everything. It's involved in every trade. And yet, you know, I suppose it's just the virtue of being the top dog, isn't it? You know, it forever draws scrutiny and predictions of its demise. I mean, what's the, you know, new now or the latest... the latest sort of spark of concern about dollars, the dollar's place?
I mean, as you say, there's always talk about international rivals. I think until now it probably would have been the euro, but it's a pretty distant second place. So that's only about 20% of global currency reserves. The latest upstart is people are talking about something called a petro yuan, which is based on this idea that if we see more trade between China and Russia and Saudi Arabia, we could actually end up seeing the energy trade sort of de-dollarized. I think that this currently looks quite overblown because trade between China and Russia and the Middle East is still tiny as a proportion of global trade. And economists think that for now, the bulk of trade is between sort of US-aligned countries, so it will probably continue to be denominated in dollars as a result.
Mark, you mean your conspiratorial leanings and familiarity with the oil market make you well-placed to chime in on this, I suspect? What's your take on the rise of the petro yuan or non-rise, as it may be?
Well, we've been hearing about this for well over a decade now as well. And as Hermione says, I mean, the dollar's position seems unassailable given its importance and its volumes over the global trade. But they would have probably said the same thing about sterling at one point. We shouldn't forget. And I guess the most interesting point with this week is that, and one that wasn't really discussed that much, was between the recent meeting between Xi and Vladimir Putin as well. There was discussion over reverting to yuan-backed oil trades in the global market. And of course, that takes on an added significance when it seems that Saudi Arabia are generally quite sympathetic to that trade as well, along with Iran. So it would be interesting to see what would happen if a significant amount of oil was traded around the world in anything other than the dollar. It has quite significant geopolitical implications as well. The reason why the US the reason why the US persistently runs these huge deficits is because of the dollar's status as the principal reserve currency in the world. But yeah, I mean, we might be talking about the same thing 2 or 3 years down the track. Mm. Who can say?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, another story seen this week is, or questions rising a little bit about the... China's One Belt One Road initiative, and I suppose questions there are over, you know, the country's ability to backstop large finance, large infrastructure projects. You know, is in the mix, I suppose, on how they're seen as a you know, alternative state to the US. What about digital currencies, Hermione? I know you've been looking at this quite closely? Are they more of a tangible threat, and how could that threat sort of manifest itself?
I mean, I think this is a really interesting one. I think in theory they could be. So international payments do tend to be quite clunky at the moment, so quite expensive. And I think that there's definitely scope for a sort of digital payment system to challenge the dollar and challenge our current way of doing things. But I think that it's more likely that this would come from a central bank digital currency, which is probably sort of less exciting than it sounds. So this wouldn't be a new kind of speculative token. It would just be a digital form of the notes and coins that central banks already use. With the dollar, we've got this idea called network effects, which basically says that there isn't much incentive for any central banks to change their reserves unless they think that another currency would offer them greater liquidity. And as we saw, you know, with the kind of fallout from the banking turmoil, central banks work together to keep credit flowing. So I think that they'd only go for a new currency if other central banks were switching too, which is realistically a really big barrier for a new currency to overcome. So maybe sort of the most likely outcome would be that a digital dollar could kind of replace the dollar as we use it now. And we've got some economists thinking that if we saw a kind of central bank dollar kick off, that could actually be even more widely used than the normal dollar is today.
Wow. So one expects the Fed is going to be, you know, front and centre of any moves to...
Yeah, it's surprisingly widespread. There are actually 114 countries looking at central bank digital currencies now. So
wow.
Even if it's at the kind of early stages, I think most countries are thinking that this is something that, you know, they're looking to develop.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, part of the reason for, you know, all this speculation, I imagine in the background is the somewhat unnerving question, which comes up again and again, of the possibility of the US, you know, political dysfunction leading to sovereign default. How might this happen? You've also written about this for the magazine this week, vis-a-vis, you know, the debt ceiling not getting passed. What's the, talk us through the scary implications.
So, well, the US is unusual in that it has a fixed debt ceiling. So in the UK, we've got sort of more flexible fiscal rules that we use. But the US is coming up against this debt ceiling now, and it's going to need to be raised if the government's going to meet its existing obligations. If it isn't raised, the government's going to approach this thing called the X date, which is basically the day that it can no longer pay for things. And analysts think that this will probably be around August, but estimates kind of range from June to September. Now, if the US government couldn't meet its obligations, it would basically have to declare a default, which would be very bad news for the dollar. Economists think that the value of the dollar would plummet, and there's even some speculation that the shock of this would sort of force the dollar to lose its status as a dominant currency. I think it's worth pointing out that it's very, very unlikely. There's going to be desire on all sides to avoid this kind of turmoil, and some agreement will probably be reached. I think it's a story that's worth keeping an eye on, because it's possible that any deal to raise the debt ceiling could come with some sort of austerity measures, which could be bad news for stocks that are exposed to government spending. And the uncertainty could definitely rattle markets in the meantime. I've seen some comment today from Goldman Sachs, and they think that this debt ceiling standoff could be nearly as disruptive as the 2011 standoff, which was a pretty close call.
Right. Okay. We'll certainly want to watch and fret about in the months ahead. Brilliant. Thanks, Hermione. Okay. So, lastly, we're gonna move from the nexus of US finance and politics to, I suppose, what passes for the UK equivalent, which is the Edinburgh reforms. Chris, you've written the cover feature this week, which is on, you know, this very wide-ranging subject of city reform and the implications for investment in the UK. So there's a lot to untangle. I suppose the backdrop to a lot of what we've been writing about in the magazine and talking about in this podcast in recent weeks has been that, you know, the seeming decline in the attractiveness of London for businesses looking to list, which you know, sort of arguably means we're coming at this from a position of not necessarily weakness, but it's often framed as as the chance to revitalize the city and the listing rules able to improve all of that. Can you sort of just start by bringing listeners up to speed, sketching out what the Edinburgh reforms are, you know, if that's not too big an ask in one question?
So the Edinburgh reforms refer to a package of over 30 financial services measures which the Chancellor set out in December last year in Edinburgh, hence the name. And as you say, the background to this is that London seems to have become less competitive against other financial centres like New York. Technology and high-growth companies like we saw with Arm recently are choosing to list in the US, while companies that are already listed in London, like Flutter Entertainment, are now thinking about listing overseas as well. UK pension investment in domestic equities have relatively plummeted over the decades too. So the Edinburgh reforms are really fundamentally an attempt to reboost the city as the government tries to create a new post-Brexit framework for UK financial services. They build upon a lot of reviews that have happened over the last few years of financial services policy. They also build upon legislation going through Parliament at the moment, like the Financial Services and Markets Bill, which revokes EU law, and the planned reforms to insurance sector capital rules. But they also contain a lot of new proposals, like a review of UK investment research, a proposal for a Bank of England digital currency, like Hermione was just discussing, and a trial for a new intermittent trading venue. So there's a lot going on.
It's kind of everything, really. I mean, the proposals, you know, of which there are many, have drawn a lot of hot takes, as you'd kind of expect. But among them I saw was Sam Woods, who's the head of the PRA, saying, you know, some of these changes could raise risk in the system. And I suppose it's also interesting that the reforms are being billed as Big Bang 2.0, which kind of conveniently forgets that about 20 years after the Big Bang 1, you know, we had this blow up in the UK banking system, which some people put down to the deregulation which entailed from those reforms in the 80s. I mean, again, and then we've also got this, you know, backdrop of sudden convulsion in the bond markets and global banking markets. Kind of feels like an inauspicious time in a way, doesn't it, to be talking about taking on risk, you know, granted with all the opportunities that the government wants to find in a sort of post-Brexit world. Is the recent sort of drama likely to dampen the rhetoric, do you think, in any way, or likely policy?
Yeah, the risk element is quite interesting. So the Sam Woods quote you mentioned was to do with the Solvency II reforms, which is the EU directive which is being repealed around insurance capital rules. Although on that, the insurance sector has welcomed the proposals more broadly, which is quite interesting. On banking, there has been criticism of proposals in the sense that they could be seen as watering down credit crisis rules. So the government is planning to change the ring fencing regime for UK banks. So current rules mean that banks with more than 25 billion of retail deposits have to separate their retail and investment banking arms, and the government wants to change that. So it wants to take banks without major investment banking operations completely out of that regime, and it's planning to consult on raising the deposit threshold to 35 billion. It's also hoping to scrap the EU law on capping banker bonuses. But as you say, given what's going on with the banking sector at the moment, it wouldn't be surprising if things were delayed or even watered down. We'll have to wait and see on that.
You quote one analyst in the piece. He talks about the impact being marginal, potentially on UK life insurers, who I suppose some investors and market watchers had been anticipating would be big beneficiaries of the you know, revision to Solvency II. But the analyst said at the same time that this might be broadly positive for the UK economy. That, I mean, the biggest detail in there appears to be that, you know, this £100 billion of capital might be unlocked for UK-bound investment. Is that, you know, is that a tangible, you know, is that a tangible figure, you think? Or, you know, what's this likely to mean for investors?
I think it is. So the whole idea behind the change to Solvency II is trying to sort of incentivise UK investment in longer-term illiquid assets, like in UK infrastructure. I think Legal in general said that they anticipate investing a lot more in UK-based assets as a result of the Solvency II reform. But as you say, the Deutsche Bank analyst I spoke to thinks it will be sort of marginally beneficial to these companies, but will bring greater benefits to the wider UK economy.
And then, you know, there's some other reforms in there which I was sort of previously unaware that people are talking about, you know, things like stamp duty, change to removal of stamp duty, lowering the threshold for corporate bond purchases. Is this, you know, are these any of these rule changes on the immediate horizon, or where are we with the kind of the consultation on a lot of this?
So I think it's important to say on those two points, the Edinburgh reforms don't say anything specifically on those, that there are more things that industry are calling for. So on stamp duty, the UK Shareholders Association said that stamp duty reserve tax, which investors pay in the UK when they buy shares, is a drag on liquidity and makes London less competitive against foreign markets. On corporate bonds, there's a working group that is currently lobbying the Treasury on simplifying disclosure requirements for new bond issues to try and get more private investors involved in the market. So there is lobbying going on behind the scenes on these issues. But again, we'll have to see what happens with those.
So in terms of pension reforms, Chris, there are some potential winners out there, which you kind of highlight in the piece. What are the sectors there that pension fund managers might be looking at a little more closely?
So central to the whole discussion really around the Edinburgh reforms is incentivising UK pension schemes to invest more in longer term assets. The government is trying to do this through the reform of Solvency II and also supporting greater consolidation of pension schemes. It also hopes to incentivise more domestic UK investment in private equity and venture capital through these pension reforms.
Yeah, okay. Well, it sounds like it's all going to play out possibly in over a timescale of years rather than weeks or months, but we will be following them closely. That's about all we have time for this week. Thanks to Chris, Hermione and Mark for your insight today, and to John Rogers and Madeline Apthorpe for producing this week's podcast. Quick shout out to my brother as well, who I recently found out listens to every podcast. And thank you if you're not my brother, and spending half an hour with us again. Dan will be back in the chair next week when I believe we'll be talking banks once more, among other things. So until then, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.